Episode 256, Anne Swanson, author of the books Science of Yoga and Meditation for the Real World.
Mine's a mistake slash an almost mistake.
I'm Mark Graben. This is My Favorite Mistake. In this podcast, you'll hear business leaders and other really interesting people talking about their favorite mistakes. Because we all make mistakes, but what matters is learning from our mistakes instead of repeating them over and over again. So this is the place for honest reflection and conversation, personal growth, and professional success. Visit our website at myfavoritemistakepodcast.com.
To learn more about Anne Swanson, her books, and more, look for links in the show notes or go to markgraben.com/mistake256. As always, thanks for listening. If you like the podcast or an episode, please share it with a friend or a colleague. And now, on with the show. Hi, welcome back to My Favorite Mistake. I'm Mark Graben. We're joined today by Anne Swanson. She is author of the internationally best-selling book, Science of Yoga, which has been translated into over 15 languages. So that's wow. I don't want to sell that short. Over 15 languages. Her new book, Meditation for the Real World, talks about and illuminates the fascinating science behind meditation with step-by-step practices. So we'll get to talk about that a little bit later on. And you know, we're going to hear more of Anne's story. Overcoming her own chronic pain and anxiety led her to India to study yoga and meditation, to China to explore Tai Chi, and to earn a Master of Science graduate degree in yoga therapy. So a lot of expertise and wisdom to tap into here today. Anne, thanks for joining us. How are you?
I'm doing well. So good to be here with you, Mark.
I'm glad that you're here. I'm going to be excited to explore these other topics. And thank you for sending me the books. They're beautifully illustrated and really impressive books. So thank you again for that. I hope people will go check them out.
My pleasure. I'm glad you like it.
So before we talk about the world of yoga and especially meditation, as we always dive into first here, Anne, you know, with the different things you've done in your career, what would you say is your favorite mistake?
Mine's a mistake slash an almost mistake. So it was this time of my life. I had just finished my graduate degree in yoga therapy, and I was searching for a job. And I was getting job rejection after job rejection. I mean, I was well over 100 rejections in. I was, you know, overqualified. You won't stay that long with it. I was so many different reasons. And I felt down as I was getting the job rejections. But I knew in my heart that there was a big opportunity coming my way if I was just patient for the right opportunity. And I just kept meditating and journaling, and I was reading like self-help books. And my friends actually later, they told me that they were about to have an intervention with me because I was getting real woo-woo, like believing that my meditation and my journaling was going to bring this into my life. And writing on my mirror words of what I wanted to feel and cultivating it despite all this constant rejection. And I, during this time, I got an email, and, you know, I didn't think much of it. I think I put it in saved emails, like, oh, I'll get to this later, because I was so focused on finding an immediate job. And I think I partly even thought it was just like a scam. They had to follow up a few weeks later.
What did that first email say?
Well, I glanced at it, so I didn't even really see what it said at that point. I was like, oh, they want me to do this thing. I don't have time for this thing. I'm looking for a job. Okay. And so then I dove into it the second time when they followed up. I'll remember it was Valentine's Day. And I looked at it and I was like, wait a second. This is a book offer, a book contract from one of the biggest publishers in the world. This is from DK, it's part of Penguin Random House. Mm-hmm. Out of the blue, I didn't have an agent. I didn't have a big social media following. I didn't have a book proposal, but they had a book proposal that is exactly the book I would have written. It was Science of Yoga. You know, I had just gotten a master's degree in the science of yoga, right? So that's the perfect opportunity to bring together all that I just learned and traveled the world to learn. So I looked closer. I was like, oh my gosh, I couldn't have written this proposal better. This is as if I wrote it. And so I ended up, you know, last minute signing this book contract and going with writing that book, which now has been translated into over 15 languages and is really widely used in like yoga teacher trainings and for people getting into yoga. But it's funny that I was so focused in on what I thought was going to be the manifestation of my dreams, which was, you know, getting a job at a spa or at a college teaching a course on yoga. Like I thought that was it. And if I had gotten any of those other jobs, there's no way I would have had time to get this. So each one of those rejections now in retrospect, I see as paving the path for me to have this contract. But I mean, my mistake was not reading closely, not being more open to like my dream coming true in a different way than I imagined. And it was a near mistake. I almost slipped up on that. They during that time could have been talking to other authors.
I think it's fascinating when someone even knows about a near mistake story, because it's possible you would have never known it was, I mean, we use the phrase near miss, but in this case, it would have been a near success. You know, that if you had ignored or been too skeptical about the second email, you would have, I'm sure, found another job, and you wouldn't have known you had made that mistake. You probably would have never dug up the email again, right?
Yeah, maybe. But it changed my life. It changed the trajectory of my life from there.
Wow. I mean, there's, I think, a lesson there about, you know, things happen for a reason, or being in a place where you could accept that opportunity to work on the book. Like, I don't know if there's any thoughts that come from your study of yoga or meditation, or if that's just Anne's reaction and worldview of why or how opportunities might appear.
I believe that I was setting myself up to be in the right, you know, vibration, alignment, energy, openness to bring in the perfect opportunity. Despite the rejections, I was resilient in that time. And yes, I did have some tears. I was not like a perfect during that time. It was very hard to get 100 rejections right after I just spent all this money on a graduate degree. But I was meditating, getting in touch with what do I truly want? And the words I was writing on the mirror were things like creativity. I need a project that's true creativity. I want something artistic and scientific, right? And I originally went to art school. So to be able to work with some of the best illustrators and designers in the world on science of yoga, was really a treat for me. So all the words that I wrote on the mirror were exactly what I brought into my life. And it sounds woo-woo, right? Like, oh, you manifest it. But if you think about it, and when you look into the science of it, when we have a goal in our business or in financials, we set the goal and then we are focused in on it. And then when we see opportunities that align with that goal, we go with it. And when we see things that don't, we don't go with them, right? We have this direction, this compass. And that's what I think I created during that time through my meditations and my journaling and my writing on the mirror, was this internal compass that attracted it into my life. And you know, that's why my friends who went to graduate school with me and studied science with me, they were like, we're going to have an intervention because you were going off the deep end being woo-woo. But I am convinced. I'm convinced that just like setting a goal with your business or finances, it truly works in your life and other aspects too.
Yeah. It seems like there's an important lesson there of, like I said, you were aiming to bring, you know, to I guess I'll use this phrase, manifest these things you wanted to happen, but it was more of that general direction of like, how were those, I would call them wishes. You were wishing for something, it would be easy to have a blind spot of, well, no, I wasn't wishing for a book, but you didn't know you were meant to be wishing for a book, but you were doing it in like this indirect way, I guess.
Yeah. And the more I've read about how to, you know, sculpt your life and create the life of your dreams, as well as the business and finances of your dreams, is we want to have a direction, but we want to be flexible, right? So I want to focus on, how do I want to feel? How do I want my life to be? And that's really what I was doing, is like, I want it to be creative. I want it to be incorporating all the knowledge that I had. I knew what I wanted. I didn't know how it would come about. And I was, and ultimately I became open to the different ways, but at first I almost made that mistake.
So how do you, I guess now you have to guard against not making that mistake at some point, now that you're aware of the possibility of some other offer or opportunity comes in.
Yeah. Now, I like the advice that Taylor Swift gives to any budding singer. They're like, oh, what advice do you have? I want to be a singer like you. Get a good lawyer. That's what she says. Oh. I think to have somebody to consult with, to look, is this contract bogus? And that's what I did, is I found a lawyer immediately. And I was like, is this contract bogus? Because I do get bogus offers for book contracts where you have to pay to write it, or it's a scam in some way. And so I asked him, he's like, nope, this is legit. And same now, as, you know, I've gotten some offers where I'm like, this doesn't seem right. And sometimes I'll get, you know, that's not very good. That's not right. But yeah, just to have somebody that's an expert to look at it, that's really helpful to get that consult.
So did you, at some point in those discussions, either before or after signing the contract, get an answer to the question of, hey, how did you find me?
Yeah, I did. So they found me through a random article that I wrote, for free or for $20. You know, you don't get paid very much for writing like yoga articles online. But they found me in the bio under the article, which was a very science-based article. I don't know exactly which one it was, but the bio under it said that I had a master's of science in yoga therapy. And they were looking specifically for somebody with a master's degree in the field. And guess what? I just graduated from the very first master's program in the field. So there are only like 28 of us in the world that could have qualified.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, not to sidetrack too much, I have a similar story of how my first book came to be about healthcare improvement. It's a book called Lean Hospitals. I had been blogging, and I was found by a publisher in an indirect way. It was through a personal introduction, where that publisher was wanting somebody to write a book in a certain direction on a certain theme. And they'd reached out to my friend Dean, and he said, no, that's probably not me, but you should talk to Mark. Yeah. So I think having that go-between, I didn't have any sort of, hey, is this a scam, you know, detectors going off. But thankfully, I was in the right place and time to be able to accept that opportunity. That I mean, it kind of fell in my lap. And I know people who have written a book and then really struggled to find a publisher. And then if they ask, well, how did you do it? I almost don't want to tell my story.
You know, I feel that way too sometimes, is that I don't want to tell, because I can't give advice on how to get a book contract. Like, I can't. My way was not the traditional way. Although publishers do have specific titles based off of SEO and what's going to do well in the market that they know they want written, and then they look through authors. That does happen. It's more rare, you know. But I think that my story highlights the importance of really being focused in on your desires, and then believing in yourself and sticking with it, being resilient amidst the failures.
Yeah. And maybe we can transition to talking about meditation in your new book. I'm guessing during those hard times with getting the rejection, meditation was one of the coping strategies or ways of building resiliency.
Absolutely. Meditation has helped me through that time, other dark nights of my soul. It helps me through daily, you know, I'm feeling like overwhelmed, doom scrolling. And that's ultimately what this new book is about, Meditation for the Real World, is it's real world situations. You're about to walk on stage and you're feeling nervous. You are grieving the loss of a loved one. You're feeling feeling social anxiety at an event, real life situations, and how to integrate short meditations to be able to target that. So even like a minute meditation makes a huge difference when you place it in that moment when you're feeling down or you're feeling anxious.
Mm-hmm. So would an example of an opportunity for a short meditation be, let's say you're in a short line at the grocery store, and instead of pulling the phone out of the pocket and scrolling, whether it's doom scrolling or fun scrolling.
Exactly.
Fit meditation into your day?
And on the cover of Meditation for the Real World, there's a woman. She's sitting with her feet grounded down. She's sitting tall. She looks relaxed amidst all these other people on a subway, all hunched over their phones and computers, distracted. She's the only one that looks peaceful, right? She's got headphones on. Maybe she's listening to a guided meditation. Maybe she's listening to a song that's really getting her to be present. You can have your eyes open. It can be loud. You can be seated in a chair. You could be standing in line. And one quick meditation you can do for these sort of circumstances is your five senses meditation. So we can do it right now in less than a minute. What, as you're listening to this, whether you're driving, walking, sitting, doesn't matter. I want you to notice what you see. Just notice it with a new vision. If you're staring at a screen, look out the window, allow your vision to broaden. Our eyes are not meant to be on these small little screens all the time. Let the vision expand. And now notice what you hear. You're welcome to close your eyes if you're safe to do so, so that you can tap into that sound. What do you hear from far away to up close, my voice, maybe even your own breath, sounds in your room. Notice what you hear. Take a deep inhale through the nose. Notice any smells. Keep breathing through the nose as you notice any tastes that are present. You might have to search for it, but just tap into that sense of taste. And then bring the awareness to your body, feeling your bodily sensations. You might even feel the urge to sit taller or do a little movement as you become aware of how your body feels right now. And pay attention internally. Maybe you feel your heart beating, your blood pumping, your breath moving you. And if your eyes are closed, now open them again and take in all your five senses simultaneously. What you hear, see, smell, taste, and feel. And then moving forward with this conversation, with your day, with that new sense of awareness. So it becomes like a reset button for your nervous system. When you're noticing you're really distracted and out of it, to come back into flow state.
I didn't realize we were going to meditate. That was nice. I mean, for those who were listening, those who were watching on YouTube, will see I closed my eyes. And I can say I meditated.
Yeah. A minute counts. You get immediate physiological benefits. We have endorphins released. We change our brain activity immediately when we start meditating. You went from this kind of more chaotic thinking brainwave activity of beta brain waves to alpha, which is more relaxed and at ease. We changed the way your heart was beating. You probably slowed down. Your blood pressure went down, all in less than a minute.
I could go at some point, look at my Apple Watch data. I won't do it right now.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, would you expect like your respiration rate probably slows as well?
Yes. Some meditations you're told to slow it, but this one I didn't tell you to. But you might have noticed that happened naturally, that your breath started to slow down. Your brain started to slow down.
Yeah. And so, well, I was going to ask this. This is a good time to do so. During the pandemic, I think when a credit card company had said, "Hey, have a free subscription to this meditation app." You know, there's many of them, but it's a popular one. I don't know if it's good, but I tried it,
And I thought, well, okay, in theory, this I think would help during uncertain, stressful times. I really struggled with it.
And what was hard for you?
What was hard?
Yeah. What was the struggle for you?
Well, I think one reflection is, I mean, I think in general, like starting with a 1 minute meditation is less intimidating.
Yeah.
I think I was dialing up, you know, a 15 minute guided meditation. And then I just didn't feel like I could focus that long. And this is where I was going to ask you of like, you know, is that, if you find your mind wandering, is that a meditation mistake? Is that a problem? Is that something you maybe get better at?
Yeah. Or is that's that, a is great better, question.
Is that even the wrong way of framing it? I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a really great question because it's probably the most common question. All your listeners are wondering this too. But it's a myth that meditation is stopping your thoughts. It is not stopping your thoughts. So meditation is a process. And I have a nice graphic in the book that explains this. So it's not just when you're focusing on the one thing. So your teacher may give you, you know, a word to repeat, you're focusing on your breath, or as I just gave you each sense, we were going into each sense. So that was our one thing we were focusing on, right? So your teacher gives you usually something to focus on. And we think that's the meditation. And if my mind wanders, then I'm not doing it right. But really, that's the first step. Second step, always, inevitably, no matter how advanced of a meditator you are, second step is spontaneous thought. Your mind will wander. The third step is critical. So the third step, our brain picks up this network of activity that determines, is that important or not? So my mind is wandering to what I'm going to eat later or my list of things to do. Is that important for this 1 minute or this 10 minutes that I've devoted to this? No, right? My mind is wandering to the smell of smoke and the fact that there might be a fire in the house. Is that important? Yes. Get out of the house, stop meditation, right? So you're going to determine, is this important or not? So once you strengthen that network to come back to focus on the focal point, you're building this new muscle, this new ability in your brain to be able to recognize when your mind wanders, which we don't always do through the day. We just believe our thoughts. And then to redirect back to your focal point. And your focal point during the day could be, you know, your work project or paying attention to your kids, right? So it helps us to get into that flow state, that awareness during our everyday activities too, because we're strengthening the network activity to notice and come back to focus. So really, it's boot camp for your focus. If your mind is wandering a lot, that just means you're getting a great workout. You're getting a great workout of that neural network activity that's necessary to come back to focus.
Yeah. My focus here is on you and what you're saying and our conversation, and that's easy to focus on. I don't feel any urge to flip over and peek at my email or something here while we're doing this. But you know, in a large group meeting though, that's a different thing. We're like here, you know, we're very active. We're both very actively engaged in this discussion. In work settings, there are times where our participation is much more passive. Do you have any thoughts on what you've learned on regaining focus in a situation like that, where it's more challenging than a one-on-one discussion might be?
Well, nobody needs to know you're meditating. Just like we were saying, you know, you're in line or you're sitting on a subway, rather than scrolling while you wait, meditate while you wait. So what we can do is while we're in this Zoom meeting, say you're on the meeting or they could see your camera, but I do top secret underground Zoom yoga. You know, I'll move my ankles a little bit. Nobody needs to know I'm doing it. I'll do some breathing, nice slow breathing, be aware of my posture. So you can bring your focal point to your five senses. You can use all these techniques during that meeting, and you're basically meditating while you're in the meeting. So nobody needs to know that you are, for example, this is a good one. No one needs to know that you're doubling your exhales. This is a really great way to relax your nervous system, is to inhale for, let's start with three counts. Inhale, two, three. Exhale, two, three, four, five, six. And continue that on your own. Doesn't have to be exactly. It could be three count inhale, five count exhale, but just longer exhale than the inhale. Nobody needs to know that you're doing that during the meeting. And now you're getting these benefits of the breathing practice and the focus.
And your eyes stay open and there's no risk that you suddenly like, what? Oh, sorry.
It'll keep you awake too. Yeah. Yes, exactly. It'll keep you awake.
I may try that. I will try that sometime. And I was going to ask also, like, when it comes to developing, practicing meditation, and sort of developing your skills there. It says in your bio that meditation didn't come easy to you. I was wondering if you could share some of that story.
Yeah, I, by nature, as a child, I was very anxious. I've always dealt with anxiety and chronic pain, which makes meditation and sitting still hard. And so I didn't come to meditation for meditation. I came to yoga for the physical practice. And when we get to the point in the yoga class where we were meditating, I'd look down at my watch. I'm like, it is time to go. I have things to do. This is a waste of time. Like, I did not get it. But over time, teachers would introduce different techniques. And every once in a while, one of them would work for me. And I'd be like, whoa, that's what it feels like to really relax, to really let that weight off my shoulders and be present. And as I got tastes of it, I wanted more and more. But it took a while of different techniques. So if you've tried meditation before and you don't think it worked for you, you might just not have been doing the right technique for you or the right technique in that situation. And that's why I wrote Meditation for the Real World, is different situations, 83 techniques you can try out.
Yeah. Oh, I'm going to try others. And I was being too hard on myself. I had too high expectations and I got frustrated and gave up on it. That's on me.
Common.
That's not on the meditation.
Yeah, that's common. But also people try to do the 15 minutes, like you said, and I say start like with 5 to 10 max. So for your listeners, I have a gift at meditationfortherealworld.com, and that's the meditation challenge. And those meditations, it's 10 minutes a day, but I give you a little context in science. So their meditations are only about 7 minutes. And I integrate music and nature sounds that have been engineered to optimize your brain waves for the practice so that if you have trouble focusing, it can help you get into that state better. So we use the science of sound also.
Yeah, I hope people check that out. I'll put a link. I'm going to check it out. I'll put a link in the show notes. And I want to talk a little bit about, you know, since you know the science of yoga and you know about meditation, some of my experience was my wife encouraging me. My wife's been practicing yoga for 20 years, you know, classes, and I think she's fairly advanced. And, you know, she was encouraging me to try it. And like you said, Anne, you know, physical reasons, lower back, you know, I'm 50 or I was approaching 50 and like flexibility and everything is, you know, and there have been great benefits from that of doing restorative yoga, yin yoga for listeners who don't know, you know, very slow hold, long holds of poses. And as my journey there, what you said sounded familiar. And at first, of, you know, I would do 25 minutes and then 5 minutes Savasana, and it would all feel like it was forever. Or I'd be laying there and I would feel fidgety and like, how long is this 5 minutes of laying here? What is that doing for me? But then now, honestly, the 25 minutes goes pretty quickly. I think, you know, the Savasana, like I'm a fidgety, I'm always moving physically or mentally, but like I've gotten much better after, you know, about 2 years, and especially getting into daily practice. That was one of my lessons of like doing it occasionally might feel okay, but like there's something to be said for doing that every single day, really connected to some definitely physical benefits. But to me, that's also been, I think, my meditation, even though I wouldn't say a meditation.
Moving meditation. Yeah.
And being still during those poses. And that's been very beneficial for me, for sure.
Yeah. It's, one of those things you build up over time. So you get started, and even if just you're doing 1 minute meditations, that counts. You're getting those immediate effects. We did one today. You felt the immediate effects. So integrating them into your life can make a really big impact, and starting small is the way to go. And as you feel the impacts, as you go into that meeting with more clarity, you play with your kids or help them with their homework with a greater sense of purpose and connection because of that 1 minute meditation, you're going to be more likely to do it, right? As you see these results.
Mm-hmm. What does the science say about, if you will, like, you know, the mind body connection of being able to get different benefits from meditation, if that helps with anxiety or attention? Yes. And does that flow through then into ways that anxiety, tension manifests, you know, in terms of physical symptoms?
It absolutely does. It's said when there's a problem in the body, the answer is in the mind. So chronic pain, actually, meditation has been the biggest thing to help me with my chronic pain, because when pain becomes chronic, it is no longer because of tissue damage, right? Like you didn't just burn your hand. It's because of a misinterpretation of your nervous system of what's going on. Like my 99-year-old grandpa, he has arthritis probably in every joint of his body, but he doesn't actually have pain. And then here I am in my 30s with this intense pain, right? It doesn't always, it really rarely makes sense. So we want to retrain our nervous system when it has to do with pain. And then there's said when there's a problem in the mind, the answer is in the body. Like when you're feeling really anxious, we know that exercise, yoga, working out really helps. Go for a run. It really helps. Walking meditation. You don't have to sit still to meditate. There's a whole section in Meditation for the Real World on walking meditation and movement meditation. So the mind-body connection is very clear at this point. And some of the most profound research to support meditation is on mental health and chronic pain, as we just talked about. Also, cardiovascular health helps lower your blood pressure, helps to lower your cholesterol, improve your heart rate variability, lessen your risk of heart disease, or even reverse the effects. So meditation is a critical component for really stress management. When we have better cardiovascular health, we have better stress management. It's helpful to every system of your body, and then it bleeds into your life, and you'll notice relationships getting better, your sleep getting better, your emotional regulation, you know, less road rage and that sort of thing coming up. Yeah.
Yeah. You used a term there. I was going to ask you the meaning or the science of heart rate variability. My wife mm-hmm. pretty recently started wearing a ring that yes. does a lot of the same measures that my Apple Watch does. And I think she was looking at the app and she was like, how's your heart rate variability? I'm like, oh, I've never looked at that. I've looked at my heart rate, sleep, and other things. And what's the importance of heart rate variability? Is more variability bad? Or
I know. You would think intuitively more variability would be bad, but it's actually good for there to be a variability between your heartbeats. And that's what heart rate variability in essence measures. We want our heart to be able to be resilient and respond to whatever situation. So somebody with really high heart rate variability, it's one of those measures. We actually want to be high compared to breath rate. It's better to be low or heart rate low. It's high is better. And so with really high heart rate variability, you know, when you're running up the stairs and then you sit down, your body is going to be able to change your heart rate really quick. And then you stand up all of a sudden, it's going to change to those circumstances. It's ready at any moment to be variable and resilient to whatever comes its way. So exercise helps heart rate variability, but also meditation, teaching your heart how to slow down amidst the chaos is really helpful for your heart's resilience. So we want our heart to be able to go from very, very slow to fast when we need it. And that's what that represents. So we want heart rate variability to be high. It tends to, depending, you know, for men, it's a little higher, different stages of life, it goes higher or lower. So those, you know, at night, it tends to be a little bit better. So it's going to be different depending on what you're doing. But overall, we want it to be higher.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, there's more data, more things to learn about with their body. It's not, what are these measures, but what does it mean? So I'll go look at that. And it seems like there's a parallel between, let's say, recovery time from strenuous exercise.
Yes.
And recovery from a stressful moment that may get your adrenaline exactly. or stress hormones going, heart rate maybe goes up. How quickly do you kind of get back to baseline?
Exactly. And that's where these meditations, these brief meditations, they could be less than a minute, a couple breath meditation of elongating your exhales, as we said, that could help you calm down after a stressful event. You know, our body naturally does it. We're like, right? But that's kind of stressful. We do it right out of our upper chest. We don't get the full lung capacity. So to mindfully elongate your exhales can help with that resiliency, help slow your heart rate and lower your blood pressure immediately after a stressful event.
Yeah. I'm going to tell a quick mistake story real quick. It was probably about 2 years ago. I had gotten some bad news work-wise and it was on a Zoom call, right? So, you know, body language is a factor too. And I thought I was taking a pause and a deep calming breath, but it looked like an eye roll and it sounded like, so to your point about the slow exhale is,
yes.
would have been less audible and,
it was dramatic. You were very dramatic.
It caused a little trouble for me. I didn't mean it to be. So I guess I wasn't in touch with, how I was reacting or my emotions there. So maybe, you know, after a practice of yoga and now maybe with the help of your book, thank you again, Anne, for sending it. I can be more resilient in those moments. And when you talk about emotional regulation, that was and a test, but maybe I failed.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sending me your book, a signed copy at that.
Oh, you're welcome. And, So that's maybe one other question here, because I like asking authors about the process of the book and combining a couple themes here. I mean, it's inevitable there's going to be mistakes in the process of writing or editing, or is there any story that comes to mind now as a multiple?
Oh my gosh. Author? Oh my gosh. I have the biggest story and I've never told it before.
Oh, we get a bonus mistake story.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So Science of Yoga, my first book, I was, you know, proud of it, but it was like 80-hour work weeks for 6 months. That's how long that we had to write it. That all their books, it's like 3 months of writing, 3 months of editing. That's it. It's very rushed. And so when it came out, you know, I let it sit for a while. I was feeling good. And then one day I opened it up, I was reading through. I was like, oh, these images are so pretty. And I found a mistake, like a really obvious, like factual. It was a typo that made the whole sentence wrong about muscle physiology. Like anybody from basic 101 would know that. And I was like, oh my gosh. And one word fix and it would be better. And I started having bad dreams. I was having dreams about the shipment of books coming from, like, you know, whatever factory in China they print them at, in a ship, and it catching fire. And I was like, this is horrible, because this means people die to not have the shipment of books go out. Like, this is the worst. I was not able to sleep. I was just obsessing over this mistake. I'm going to get so many negative reviews. You know, I was nervous about the people in my field that I sent books to, sample books of it. And, you know, the book came out and, you know, I guess I've gotten some critical reviews. Nobody's ever noticed it. The second print, they fixed it. It took like a few months for them to have a second print, but they fixed it second print, and that's great. But I never got a negative review. Nobody ever said a comment. No, it was just this like thing that I obsessed over. And I actually, you know, I feel like that was my mistake, was obsessing over it, because the thing that you think people are going to notice is not what they're going to notice. And I mean, I got depressed and anxious, and meditation got me through that time. It really did. You know, and I think whatever author there is, I've heard stories of authors going from bookshop to bookshop with whiteout pens or erasers, scratching out the mistakes. I've heard stories. This is not an uncommon feeling because once it's done, it's done. Like, you don't get to fix it like a blog post.
Yeah. Or, you know, like you said, that other printing. But I mean, you know, my books are not through a major publisher. Amazon doesn't let me into their warehouses to go and try to.
Yeah, you've thought about it too.
there is a difference. But when I had traditionally published books, that first edition of my first book, the first printings, had a typo on page one. And I swear it wasn't in the manuscript. I think the typo got injected during the page layout process. But I know another author through a major publisher who also, you know, typo on page one. So like, all right, get it out of the way.
I haven't told anybody this either, but it looks like there's a typo on the back of the new book. I'm not going to tell you what it is now. You just have to get the book to see. On the back of A Meditation for the Real World, it's not a typo, but I remember you don't, as an author for a major publisher, you don't get to write the front or the back of the book. You don't, like, I got a final say, but I had to be pushy even to get that final say. Like, you don't get to write it. And so they wrote it. And I remember looking at the first word. So not even just on the back cover, but the first word, I remember being like, that's a weird word to put there. Is that a typo? And then I thought about it and I looked it up. I was like, yeah, I mean, that word could mean that. Okay. Maybe that's something they say in the UK. They'll change it for the US edition. So it's come out. I've gotten only close friends. My brother and a couple of close friends have been like, oh man, real bummer about that typo in the back cover. And I'm like, it's not a typo, but I thought it was weird too. So anyways, you know, if you see that on the back, it's not a typo, but it is a weird word to start the back cover. Authors do not get to write that.
Not Anne's fault. But final thing, I mean, it's just like, you know, author to author, even some of the first printings of The Mistakes That Make Us had a couple small little typos, one very minor factual error. I will, you know, but okay, nothing that discredits the entire book. It was a very minor thing. But I do know, like, if flip to a certain page and look for a certain thing, I know the person with that book was one of the very first to buy it. And I can thank them for that. So maybe you can turn that into a positive if you see somebody with a copy that has, you don't have to maybe tell them what you were looking for. But
well, they say that the first print, first edition of every book is the most valuable. And it is because it has those little typos and mistakes. So if you're a book collector, and even if you can get a signed copy of a first print, first edition, that's why they're so valuable. And I think that that's a really great lesson to the theme of your show, is that mistakes are what make something so special. The later edition, they're not as valuable.
And I think your point about not obsessing over the mistake after the fact is a really good lesson, a helpful reminder. So, well, thank you for that, Anne. This has been fun. So our guest today, Anne Swanson, is the author of Science of Yoga, new book, Meditation for the Real World. There's probably another book in your future?
There is. But yeah, definitely want to remind your listeners to go to meditationfortherealworld.com. That's where you can get the meditation challenge. It's really special. And I think you'll be able to stick with it. It's 5 days, less than 10 minutes a day.
I'm going to sign up too. So again, there'll be links in the show notes to the books, Anne's website, social media, and more. So, and thank you for doing this today. Thank you for the education. Thank you for the meditation. This has been great.
Thank you.
Thanks again to Anne Swanson for being here with us today. To learn more about her and her books, her website, and more, you can look for links in the show notes or go to markgraben.com/mistake256. As always, I want to thank you for listening. I hope this podcast inspires you to reflect on your own mistakes, how you can learn from them or turn them into a positive. I've had listeners tell me they started being more open and honest about mistakes in their work. And they're trying to create a workplace culture where it's safe to speak up about problems, because that leads to more improvement and better business results. If you have feedback or a story to share, you can email me, myfavoritemistakepodcast@gmail.com. And again, our website is myfavoritemistakepodcast.com.